Good morning. It's The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly show about health, fitness, nutrition, mental health, and lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Today in the program, we first speak with Marielle Pattisot. She's the tooth fairy. No, really, she is the tooth fairy for outstanding dental health in Summit County, something that some of us think is easy to achieve, but not so. She joins us to talk about her ongoing efforts in the county to spread good dental health.
And then a sombering but illuminating interview with Sue Klebold, who has written a book called A Mother's Reckoning, Living Life in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Sue Klebold is Dylan Klebold's mother. Dylan, along with Eric Harris, were the high school age shooters at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado in 1999, who took their own lives at the end of their brutal killing spree. Sue is a very brave individual, and we're honored that she'll be joining us to talk about the tragedy at Columbine, her personal tragedy, and now her crusade for brain health awareness. She donates the proceeds of her book to various charities that deal with mental health. She'll be joining us in the second half of the hour by phone. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Chris Eggleton.
And Chris Retzer of Destination Hotels Utah, proud sponsor of KPCW.
Since 2005, we've provided nightly rental, retail, and community management services
to New Park Town Center, Prospector Square, Empire Pass, and Toohey.
More information about Destination Hotels Utah is at dhutah.com.
The Utah Legislature meets for 6 weeks from the end of January till mid-March, and KPCW News will cover all major developments affecting the Wasatch Back and you. Reports from Capitol Hill and your lawmakers are brought to you by Tesh Law, real estate, trusts and estates, and general litigation since 1989. TeshLaw.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, there's a population of people for whom dental health is not a given, even right here in Summit County. And there's a woman out there crusading for oral health. She teaches oral health workshops all over the county and makes her way into every school in the district and beyond to teach proper brushing and flossing. Marielle Pattisot, a.k.a. the Tooth Fairy, brought her wand and her floss, I hope, into the KPCW studios this morning. Marielle Pattisot, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning, Lynn. How are you?
Nice to have you back. We talked to you, maybe last year, or who knows, even the year before, but during Children's Dental Health Awareness Month, or is it just Dental Health Awareness Month?
It's a mouthful. It's National Children's Dental Health Month, the whole month of February. And this is what spurs me into action every year, is to come in to the school system and do as much as I can to change the profile of dental disease.
Now, some of the statistics you give are somewhat staggering. Poor dental health tooth decay is 4 to 5 times more prevalent in children than even asthma, which is something we think of as being quite common, unfortunately.
Yes, yes. And what's even more sobering is almost all children are born with perfect teeth. Enamel is the hardest tissue in the whole body. It's more than twice as hard as bone. And tooth decay is almost totally preventable. So what are we doing with this kind of statistics of tooth decay being the number one disease in childhood and 4 to 5 times more prevalent than asthma? What are we doing and what do we need to change?
So number one would occur to me, what are we feeding our children that's contributing to that decay? But maybe that's not the first question.
Well, it is. It is and it isn't. In order to have tooth decay, it's really, really simple. You need 3 ingredients. If you're missing just one of those 3 ingredients, tooth decay is not possible. So the number one is teeth, of course. The number 2 are bacteria, and number 3 is sugar. So let's address your question about sugar. When I started my Kickstarter campaign, which we're going to come back to later, I made a vow that I would avoid all added sugar in my diet for a period of 30 days, the duration of my campaign. Well, I'm afraid that I am not successful at all because I'm busy. I don't have time to prepare my own food. So when I buy processed food. And I could not find bread without sugar in it. I could not find canned or boxed soup without sugar in it. There is sugar in everything. There's even sugar in sausage in this country. So we consume way too much sugar. So that is part of the problem.
Mario, when you just said in this country, you can't, you know, there's even sugar in sausage in this country. Is there sugar in everything across the globe in processed food, or are there countries that have identified sugar as the problem that we hear it is on this program all the time? I mean, we're always talking about sugar and the detrimental impacts mm-hmm. on general health, but mm-hmm. you're specifically looking at dental health.
Yes.
But what have other countries done, if anything?
Done, I'm not sure, and I don't really have solid statistics on that, but I know that in Asian countries, they consume far less sugar than we do. We, in North America, we typically consume a lot of sugar.
It's interesting because, you know, the Asian diet is assumed, it's been identified as being high in vegetables, and
yes.
they eat a lot of really healthy greens, and there's this connection to lower incidence of cancer and heart disease mm-hmm. and all sorts of things. And I'm not, you know, I mean, it could be that, or it could be that they don't put as much sugar into their processed foods. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm wondering if anybody's kind of yeah. looking at that connection.
They eat less processed food and they put less sugar in their processed foods. Yeah. And in Japan, they do both. They have less sugar in their diet. They have less sugar in their processed foods. And the children also brush their teeth in school.
And isn't there a difference? I mean, I'm not sure, but I heard this with my kids when they were really young. You know, when they get a cavity and we're like, oh my gosh, how did that happen? In a baby tooth? You know, how do you get a cavity in a baby tooth? I was unaware until I had children doing that. We didn't have a big incidence, but it surprised us when it happened. And then we were told, oh, well, you know, sometimes your child's enamel is just a little softer. Mm-hmm. But you've just said enamel is the hardest element in the human body.
Yes. And most children are born with perfect enamel. So this saying of I have soft tooth and I've inherited that from my mother or whatnot, there's actually a very, very small percentage of children who are born with imperfect enamel or imperfect teeth.
And when you say small, is that like a fraction of a percentage or 5%?
It's less than 5%.
Less than 5%.
So there's a very small percentage of children who are actually born with imperfect teeth. The rest of them acquire the bacteria, usually from their mother, and then with the diet. And one of the big problem that I've identified since I've moved to Utah, and it's not just happening here, it's a global problem. Parents don't really know that they need to brush their children's teeth until about age 6, 7, or even 8 in some cases, depending on the dexterity of the child. So usually what happens is a parent gives a toothbrush to a 2 or 3 year old and expects the child to brush his or her teeth. And usually what happens is the child chews on the toothbrush. It kind of looks okay. It looks good. But a parent really needs to set the tone of proper brushing is implemented and is done by an adult until the child is 6 to 8 years of age.
Mm.
And if that doesn't happen, there's a great chance that the child will have tooth decay. And I have to share a little story because it's kind of funny. Last year, I was babysitting my grandsons, and I was preparing their lunches before they went to school, and I sent them to brush their teeth before going to school. And I had a sneaky feeling that things were not quite happening, so I tiptoed to the bathroom, and the three of them were giggling. They had their suction bottom toothbrush on the door of the bathroom. The toothbrushes were on, and the flashing green, yellow, and red lights were on. There was toothpaste on the bristles, but they were all there giggling, watching their toothbrush on the bathroom door. So if I wouldn't have been there, technically they were in the bathroom, the toothbrushes were on, and there was toothpaste on the bristles, but their teeth were certainly not benefiting from this toothbrushing session.
No, not at all. They were being entertained, however.
Yes, and they were having a blast, actually. I still smile at the memory.
That's actually
pretty funny image to have. I was, speaking of images, I was watching Anthony Bourdain the other night, and he was in Oaxaca, Mexico. And he, you know, was talking with a family. And in the background, you saw this parent. I didn't know if it was a mother or father who tipped the Coca-Cola bottle up to their toddler's mouth to help him take a drink of this Coca-Cola. And I've heard that that's quite prevalent, especially in certain communities, maybe in our Latino community, but also I think in general, the prevalence of sugar. I mean, that's very egregious, that presence of sugar. But yeah, talk about the other ways, and you know, is it in entire communities of people that are giving sugar to their kids?
There is a belief that rewarding kids with something sweet is something, an expression of love. And I want to honor that. Mm-hmm. And there's a great need to educate people to other ways of rewarding children. And to go back to your image of the Coca-Cola being offered to a toddler, the World Health Organization recommends that children below the age of 2 receive no added sugar. That is zero added sugar. And there's a correlation between kids who receive sugar below the age of 2 and obesity and tooth decay later in life, or even very early in life. And yesterday I was doing a special clinic at the People's Health Clinic, and we saw people all day from 9 in the morning until, I was there from 8:30 until 9 yesterday, 9 at
wow.
night, so more than 12 hours. It was a long day. It was very successful. We saw a lot of people, and I saw so many children as young as 2 years of age, with a mouthful of tooth decay. And this doesn't need to happen. So there's a great need for education in the community. And talking about that, I'm giving a talk tonight at St. Mary's Church at 5 o'clock to talk about these issues and address the cultural habits of people giving sweets to very young children and putting children to bed with a bottle of milk or a bottle of juice, which causes terrible problems.
Yes. Even, I mean, the most natural of substances, breast milk has a lot of, obviously it's not added sugar, but it is sugar. And if the baby goes to sleep with a mouthful of that, I mean, even something like that could damage.
Yeah. What people don't know is, I don't know about breast milk. I don't know the exact content of sugar in breast milk. I need to research that. But in cow's milk, in one serving, 8 ounces, there's close to 3 spoons of sugar, natural sugar in that. And the bacteria don't care. If it's sugar, it's sugar. Whether it's natural, organic, or whatever it is, sugar is sugar. And for bacteria, it is harmful.
And the bacteria just lives in your mouth. I mean, that's a natural occurrence. Everybody has bacteria in their mouth.
Yes, everybody has. In a healthy mouth, we have about 400 different species of bacteria. And only a small percentage of those bacteria are harmful. And typically, those harmful bacteria love sugar and they love acid. When we start consuming too much sugar, you're feeding those harmful bacteria. And then you start seeing a shift in the balance of the bacteria. And when we do a saliva analysis of a person who's having a lot of problems, a lot of tooth decay, a lot of times we'll see only 40 different species of bacteria instead of 400. And a high percentage of harmful bacteria. So you see a big shift, and it has to do with diet. So it goes back to your first question, Lynn.
Right.
What about the acidic component? You mentioned sugar and acid.
And acid. Well, typically the bacteria that process sugar, they turn that into acid. And these bacteria have developed a way of being able to live in an acidic milieu. So when the mouth becomes more and more acidic, so when you consume drinks that are high in sugar and also acid, like all the fruit juices, all the pops, all the soda, all the sport drinks, they're acid and contain a lot of sugar, you are creating an environment that is very favorable for the harmful bacteria. So you're feeding the bacteria better than you're feeding yourself. And we don't need that much sugar anyways.
Right. I had a friend who used to, you know,
well, say it was inevitable that children would get cupcakes at a birthday party or even at for a class birthday, and the sugar is prevalent, as you say, she would have her daughter just rinse with water every time after, no matter what it was, you know, a sip of a Gatorade, then rinse with water. Is that effective, or do you have to go in with the brush and with the floss?
Rinsing with water is always a good idea. So that at least you remove the food debris and you don't feed as many bacteria. But you really need to go in with brush and floss. And what I would like to see is children flossing and brushing in school. Because
then
we
you
go
know
back.
What happens.
That's right. Going back to that equation, we need the teeth, the bacteria, and the sugar. Well, we already know that we don't want to get rid of our teeth, and we already know that it's extremely difficult to get rid of all the sugar in the diet, especially if your diet is high in processed foods. So it really only leaves the brushing and the flossing to physically remove the bacterial film from close to the gum line and in between the teeth. And that means flossing and brushing. And I believe that if we add the component of supervised flossing and brushing in elementary school systems, we're going to make a huge difference. And I'm not inventing this wheel because in Scotland, they've already done such a thing. They do a supervised brushing program across the nation in Scotland.
Every day.
Every day, school children brush their teeth in the classroom, and they have shown consistently in Scotland that everywhere they implemented this program, starting in the mid-80s, that every time there's an uptake in toothbrushing, you see a downwards curve in the incidence of tooth decay. So when I saw this program, I thought, we could do this. But when you think about it, when you only brush your teeth, you're only cleaning 60% of your teeth because each tooth has five surfaces. When you brush, you're really only brushing. I'm really sorry about this.
Was that your timer to remember to floss your teeth?
It's time to brush and floss right now. But when you only brush your teeth, you're really only brushing the cheek surface, the tongue surface, and the chewing surface. And you're leaving two surfaces, the front and the back, behind. So if you do the math, you're really only cleaning 60% of your mouth. So we're missing 40%. And for me, that's a failing grade. So I really wanted to implement also flossing into the school system and have it supervised so that we make sure that the children floss correctly, brush correctly, and for the correct amount of time, at least once a day after lunch.
Boy, you could even do that in workplaces. Have supervised flossing for adults like you,
Tim. I think you would be a good supervisor.
I'm way into flossing, to say the least. This is interesting, though, and I'm wondering about, you talk about oral health. To me, that says teeth and gums. Are children ever at risk of having gum disease?
Oh, yes.
I think of that as being something that adults have.
Children too. You wouldn't believe the number of children I saw yesterday that when I brushed my teeth with them, this is what I do when we have a clinic at the People's Health Clinic, is I give the child a toothbrush and we brush together and I coach through the brushing. And you wouldn't believe the number of children who were spitting blood into the sink yesterday at the People's Health Clinic. So yes, children do have gum disease and it's related to the bacteria in the mouth. And that is when we see a child with red bleeding gum, that is automatically placing that child in a high risk level of tooth decay. It goes together.
You know, and your point, Lynn, that you thought it was only adults that suffered from gum disease. I was a poor flosser, actually. I didn't ever floss until relatively recently.
Until you met me.
Thank you, Lynn.
And now I'm a very regular flosser, but the other thing that I fought off and denied for a long part of my life was wisdom teeth. I had my wisdom teeth until just 3 years ago, and I'm 58 years old, so that's a little odd. And I was told by every dentist that I ever saw that I should have my wisdom teeth pulled, but none of them could give me a reason that prompted me to follow through and do it until, and this has to do with the gum disease, you know, they for the last 15 years, they've been probing my gums, and they do a count, and they say, you know, a 6, a 5, or an 8, or whatever it is.
And back there, the measures were getting bigger
and they were getting bigger and bigger, and they were able to demonstrate that they were getting bigger. And then they explained to me that's because of the bacteria that was hiding in the recesses around my wisdom teeth. And if I pulled my wisdom teeth, I would have less... I would create less of an ability for that bacteria to hide, and my brushing and flossing would get it out.
Isn't it unfortunate that you didn't get that explanation earlier?
Well, I, you know, not yet. Well, yes, it is, I guess. Although, you know, having my wisdom teeth pulled wasn't something that I would ever have looked forward to.
But you know what?
Although it went fairly smoothly.
It would have been easier having done it younger.
Yeah.
And you would have preserved your health back there in a better way.
Well, my health's not too bad. My teeth are in pretty good shape. I've got some cavities in the back and all. But, you know, I just... to find that there are kids that are suffering from this is really amazing. Do they probe the gums of children, or is that something that's not even done because you just assume that they don't have that concern with wisdom teeth and all?
It's not done on a regular basis to probe the gums of children. I used to do it in my own office because I wanted to make sure that I had a handle on things, that I would catch things early. So it would be a good idea to probe gums on kids, and it doesn't take a lot of time.
We have just a couple minutes left. You have a Kickstarter campaign. What are you doing?
Yes, I do. It's an ambitious plan. I made a presentation at the Summit County Board of Health in July, and my presentation was received very well, and they said that it would be nice to have a supervised flossing and brushing program across all kindergarten classrooms in Summit County. So I've been working on that since then and having difficulties raising funds. So I thought about a Kickstarter campaign, and if I reach my goal of $40,000, we will be able to launch supervised flossing and brushing programs across all kindergarten classrooms in Summit County. That is 3 school districts. Right now, I'm at 12%. I'm still working really hard, and I still believe that we will meet that goal of $40,000. And I'm counting on people's help right now to jump in and do it.
What's the campaign called on Kickstarter?
The campaign is called Opal, and Opal is a toothbrush I invented with the help of the PCCAP students and together with little alpha testers in McPolin School in kindergarten. So it was a really, really nice process that started back in January 2015. And so Opal, it stands for OH is oral health, and PAL is your best friend. So Opal was designed to become everyone's best friend and to keep teeth and gums healthy for a lifetime. So the Kickstarter campaign is Opal, the disposable toothbrush with a social purpose. And you can just go to Kickstarter.com and just search for Opal, O-H apostrophe P-A-L, and you will find it. I'm thanking you ahead of time for supporting me because this will make a really big difference for all children, especially for the ones who need it the most in this county. So if we could launch a program of supervised flossing and brushing across the county next school year, that would be great. And I hope to launch in McPolin School as early as the first week of March. That was a special request because they've been collaborating with us since January 2015.
So that's where parents and kids will see you next, most likely at McPolin Elementary.
I've been spending a lot of time there, and I'm going back. And actually, they'll see me at Trailside as well, where I have 2 more workshops with the grade 2 students at Trailside next week.
Wonderful. And, you know, we learn so much from our school children when they learn. My kids in elementary school, after Inza Riepen had gotten a hold of them from the recycling center, I learned so much about recycling that I already thought I knew. And LED light bulbs from Mary Krista Smith. And with the Tooth Fairy, Marielle Pariseau here, going around to schools, even adults can learn what they might not know. And we don't know a lot, as it turns out.
There's a lot to know about teeth, and I'm here to make a difference. I'm here to help.
And if people want to get a hold of you to give a presentation or just in general, how do they find you?
There's a website. It's teethfirst.com. So teeth like your teeth and first like number one, all in one word, .com. You can find a whole bunch of information there, and you can contact me through the website as well. Or you can dial 435-503-7819 and reach me directly on the phone you heard ringing earlier.
Oh, after all, it was your phone. Okay. Marielle Parizeau, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be talking with Sue Klebold about her book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Stay with us. It's The Mountain Life.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise grants and donations focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our local communities. Grants fund programs that are designed to help kids achieve in the classroom and develop an interest for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and our employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
Utah Olympic Park offers outdoor fun all winter long. Tackle an adventure ropes course or bravely step off the drop tower for a 65-foot free fall. Winter adventure activities are open 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday. Visit UtahOlympicLegacy.org for more info.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. On April 20th of 1999, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold walked into Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, where they killed 12 students and a teacher, wounded 24 others before taking their own lives. For the last 17 years, Sue Klebold, Dylan's mother, has lived with the indescribable grief and shame of that day. How could her child, the promising young man she had loved and resided with, be responsible for such horror? And how, as his mother, had she not known something was wrong? Sue Klebold has written a stunning book. It's called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. She donates all the proceeds of her book, we might mention, to various charitable organizations, including Mental Health America, National Alliance on Mental Illness, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and others. We're very honored that Sue Klebold could be joining us today on The Mountain Life. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Sue, to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn.
Wonderful to have you. And Sue, I just have to say I'm shaking as I read this introduction. Aww. And I think it's because in some ways, it's because you are the mother that we all want to be. You're the mom like I am of two sons. You're the doting mother, the one who adores and guides her sons, who teaches them the hard lessons, who observes their emotions, who sits down for dinner every night with a family dinner when they were growing up, all of these things, and yet you miss the signs. And not only did you lose a son to suicide, ultimately you raised a murderer, as you say. And I think that you wrote the book in part to help all of us recognize the signs, no matter how subtle they are.
Yes, I did. I wrote the book for many reasons. Certainly one was because it helped me to write. I wrote originally with no intent of publishing. I just wrote because journaling helped me with all of the horrible feelings that I was having. But as time went on, I could talk with people and see how my story impacted others and the way that they related to their own children. Then I began to feel more of an obligation or kind of a moral imperative to share this story and see if there was anything about my story that might help someone else help someone they love.
And it's so interesting to me. My mind goes to something that I read in the beginning of the book that talks about just how you have done that, that you have helped other parents press for more information. You talk about one in particular, after reading your book, after hearing your stories, went to her daughter. Something seemed off with the daughter. She pressed, then she pressed for more. She pressed for more, and finally she learned from her daughter that she had been raped. And I think this hit home with me so much because we press our kids only to a certain point. And then when they don't talk, you kind of leave them to their own privacy or their non-sharing behavior.
Yes. excuse me, we do that. And I think one of the other things that we do as parents is we do try so hard to pull information out of our children. But sometimes when they do open up to us or begin to talk, we listen in such a way that it shuts that talking down. And I certainly feel that I was guilty of that, but my parents raised me the same way. I remember growing up and I might be upset or crying because I thought I was ugly or nobody liked me or I was stupid, and my mother would say, but I love you, and, you know, I think you're pretty. And in reality, I think it might have been more helpful had she and then had I just listened to what they were trying to say and not try to fix it, not try to talk them out of the feelings, but to just listen. And I really feel, of all the things that I might have done differently, that's my greatest regret, is that perhaps I did try to get Dylan to talk to me, but I don't think I listened in such a way where he felt able to tell me the pain that he was in.
Sue, I'm going to ask something that I think has to be asked, probably not what you're expecting, but, you know, reading your book, it leads me to a place of fear, because, and which is odd, because I'm a parent, and I think every parent who would read your book would come away going, you know, as you said, if you follow this recipe, if you follow this formula, if you do all these things correctly, then your child certainly engages and maybe even thrives. You know, worst cases, they survive. But nothing horrible happens. And yet we all find out from your story, and I think some of us have experienced it ourselves, that that's not necessarily the case. And one of the doors that gets open to me is that if we can't tell, because our children are so good at presenting whatever they're going to present and not sharing what they don't want to share, even when they're in a loving environment, then we don't know. And how can we know? And that's a very fearful outcome for any parent, I believe.
Well, I know that my book is a frightening story, because I certainly believed before Columbine happened that something like this could never happen to me, because I believed I was a good parent and a responsive one, and that's why I wanted to tell this story. I don't want to frighten people into thinking that their children will become mass murderers, because statistically speaking, the chances that someone you love would do something as horrible as that are one in millions. However, the chances that someone you love might be suffering internally, might be struggling through a period of time where they are having thoughts of suicide, of angst, of deep unhappiness, of disconnection, the chances that that could be going on right before your eyes and you're not seeing it, those are very, very great. And I wanted people to realize that very rarely would something like a Columbine tragedy happen. But quite frequently, someone we love might be suffering, might be having thoughts of suicide, might be feeling isolated and desperate right before our eyes, and we don't see it, and we don't know how to reach that person.
You know, it's interesting, your entire book is fascinating and incredibly interesting. All the themes that you pursue and lay out are just, you do it beautifully and wonderfully, and thanks for doing that. But, you know, Littleton, what I understand of Littleton from your book is very much like Park City, and we are having a very similar conversation, part of it because we've been told that our community is ripe for the conversation. Now, 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't ripe for the conversation, and I'm assuming that probably was the case in Littleton. Bullying was happening, but it wasn't really being called out. Kids were depressed, but it wasn't really being recognized. People were committing suicide, but it wasn't being linked to the right things. And we are in the midst of that conversation right now here in Park City.
Well, and that's wonderful. And what I see is worldwide, this conversation is happening now. And that's one of the reasons I felt safe enough to actually publish this book, because there was a lot of fear for me to come forward as the mother of a murderer and be a public person. I was terrified of that. But I believe that the tide is changing and people are beginning to recognize the numbers aren't lying to us. We know that we have severe problems that we need to do a better job to try to help people. And we need to have, and it's not just a question of, it's not just a question of recognizing warning signs in a vacuum. We have to develop communities of recognition. You know, the school systems have to do a better job of helping people. Colleges have to do a better job. Public health, our family physicians, emergency departments. People are coming to emergency departments in crisis, and they're not prepared because more and more people now are recognizing that when they have toxic and lethal thoughts, that this is a symptom of something going wrong, and the emergency departments are overrun with people, and they're not, they don't have enough beds, they don't have places to send them. Even criminal justice, because Dylan and Eric had been arrested about 14 months before they died for stealing something. And really, I believe his troubles sort of were beginning when he was involved with the criminal justice system. But the way that it was treated way back then, and the parents were removed, we weren't ever allowed to talk with the diversion counselor. We have completely gone a 180 from that now, and we involve families when kids get in trouble. So I see a thousand things happening. It's like this giant jigsaw puzzle, and all these pieces are moving around like ants, and we're trying to build nets and systems, and it involves education and credentialing and certainly just the common man, just all of us. We need to do a better job of understanding what happens when someone's thoughts are deteriorating and how we can help them and how we can listen better and get them connected with helpful resources.
Sue, I want to follow up on that exact theme. With all those pieces that are moving that you just referenced and that jigsaw puzzle, is there any community that you look at and say, this is the model, this is what I would like to see, this is the jigsaw puzzle put together? Because we've had presentations from Community of Caring, templates like that, that we're looking at and examining. Is there a resource that you can point to and say, this is the path, you know, maybe it's not the complete puzzle, but this is the path to achieving that puzzle?
I don't see one big overarching framework just yet. What I see are some excellent initiatives and projects that are taking place. And as these get resolved and worked out, I believe that all these little structural pieces are going to kind of come together into one larger one. Certainly, we have, let's just toss out some great resources. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is a phone number that's been around for years that people can call 24/7, day or night, 1-800-273-TALK. And if people are experiencing an emotional crisis and feelings of suicide, they can call this number anytime and get access to a trained professional who can help them connect with resources. That's a great service. We have the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention at the national level, who's broken into different task groups to try to get at some of the components of what contributes to the problem of suicidality. We have initiatives within the healthcare system, such as the Zero Suicide Program. We have initiatives within education, such as the threat assessment programs, and they go by many different names, but really what they are is a student care-focused program that tries to help students who are showing signs of struggle. If they'd had such a thing when Dylan had originally gotten in trouble when he was in 11th grade, and he probably would have been called out and had a screening and had some extra care. So long answer is I don't see one thing emerging yet, but what I see is a lot of good work happening. And this is a complex issue, and it's going to take a lot of complex solutions, like fighting cancer. It's not one simple thing.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Sue Klebold. Her book is A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Sue is Dylan Klebold's mother. Dylan, along with Eric Harris, walked into Columbine High School in 1999 on a shooting spree, which ultimately ended in them taking their own lives. Sue, there are so many things that you go through in the first half of the book, talking about, first of all, you never want to diminish, and I want to make sure I say this, but the tragedy of all of the lives that were lost and those who were wounded for the rest of their lives. And you have all this guilt and shame around that because you're also at the same time grieving the loss of your son, who you adored, who was the easy son, who was joyful and fun and all of the things that showed that he would be, he was the son with all of the promise. He did origami. This story that you tell about the origami was just, I don't know, that just hit me really. Because it shows what a thoughtful young man he was, and how much you loved him. So, I guess I just want to ask you about the denial that you went through. That it really took until 6 months later, until you viewed the tapes, the basement tapes. How much you were in denial about it. So talk about this, because I think we are many times in denial about our children and what they're up to.
Yes, and one of the things that certainly that I have to struggle with always, even now, almost 18 years later, is I still every day am very, very conscious of the lives that he took, the families that he, I won't use the word destroyed, but I think, you know, all the hearts that were broken, the people who have endured physical disabilities and will do so for the rest of their lives. These are lasting, horrible memories, you know, that things that none of us can ever get past. And I'm sorry, you got me thinking. Always when I think about the victims of the tragedy, I go to a place, and it's very hard for me to come back to reality, and I am completely spaced out. Your question, please ask me the question again.
Absolutely. It was a long question, and I'm unsure of whether I can even remember it. No, it was about denial, but I want to also mention, while we're on the topic of the other families, that you very laboriously, very sincerely wrote each of them, beginning with the 12 and the teacher. You wrote each of them a personal letter, which was, we know it was so hard for you.
It was very hard, and I did. There's no rule book for what's the right thing to do when your child does something like this. And, of course, I was raised, you know, the post-Eleanor Roosevelt era, and I believe there were, you know, there are rules for how we conduct ourselves, and Emily Post, and I found myself in this position of just being at a loss. What in heaven's name can I do to somehow make up for this, to atone for this, to try to have some personal connection? And writing letters was the only thing I could think of to do at that time. So let's talk about denial. I remembered the question. Mm-hmm. When this first happened, and I was hearing that it was happening, I was very confused. You know, they were, you know, the police came, they were saying Dylan was a shooter. In my mind, this was some kind of a prank that had gone wrong, because he had said something to me in passing that there was going to be a senior prank. And when this shooting happened, the thing that my mind went to was, oh, this is some kind of theater the kids are pulling off, and everybody has this wrong. So right from the beginning, I was in denial about it being real. And then my mind would jump, and I would think, maybe this is real. Maybe people are really being hurt. And then my thought was, Dylan couldn't hurt anybody. Maybe they were staging something, and someone gave him live ammunition, and he wasn't aware of it. I mean, it sounds silly, but these were actually my thoughts. Some of his friends believed that somehow he was tricked or brainwashed or coerced or had gotten in with bad people who had done something that threatened him. I remember my husband thinking, maybe someone threatened us and he did this to protect us. I mean, it was, in looking back, it looked silly, but we really believed that. For 6 months, we waited for the police report to come out. And when the police report finally came out in October, and we went to hear what the sheriff's department had to say, their investigation. It was beyond shocking and appalling because for the first time, I finally understood how Dylan appeared to other people, what he had done. They had created tapes where they recorded what they were doing and what they were planning, and he looked so, you know, horribly cruel and sadistic and disdainful and detached. And then I had gone there with questions to try to answer, you know, how did Dylan get here? Because I didn't believe he was there on his own up until 6 months later. And then they outlined their plan, and it sort of started my grief all over. I had to back up to the day and re-grieve with this in mind, that my son really was intentionally there, that he planned to be there. And it was a very difficult process to kind of integrate and absorb this other Dylan into my memories and my sorrow.
Sometime afterwards, the Sheriff's Department shared a copy of all the notes that they had taken from Dylan's room on the day of the Columbine, of the event. And you went back over those notes. They were copious. And come to find out, unbeknownst to you, with no signs whatsoever, Dylan had been contemplating suicide for 2 years previous to this day. How?
Yes.
And again, of course, you asked yourself, how did I miss this?
Right. I remember when I read that, just weeping and weeping, my heart just aching, because 2 years before this incident occurred, he was writing that he was in agony, that he wanted to end his life, that he was hoping he could get a gun. He wrote that he was cutting himself. And my heart broke, and I thought, you know, how could he be suffering to that extent, and how could I not see it? And in the years following the shootings, as I became more and more involved with the suicide survivor community, I became active in some local boards, did some help with events to try to do suicide prevention and fundraising. And the more I met other survivors of suicide loss, I could see that we really fell into kind of two groups. About half of us, almost half of us, had no idea that our loved ones were suffering, and the suicide came as a complete shock to us. The other half had been working with that individual and trying to help them get help for years. And after years of hospitalizations and counseling, they had ultimately lost their loved one as well, which to me pointed out the path that we need to take in this large picture you were talking about earlier. And that is, one of our biggest challenges is to educate all of us in how to understand what warning signs are, how to help and how to intervene, how to ask, how to listen. And everybody should have at least mental health first aid training. And then the other big area we need to work on is our systems of support, our training. How many therapists have been trained in suicide intervention and prevention? How many people have had that in their training curriculums when they want to be a counselor or a teacher? How often is a suicide prevention training involved in that? Very rarely. How many states require that kind of training for people who do counseling? Very few. So these are the areas where I think we will need to focus.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Sue Klebold. She's the mother of Dylan Klebold, about her book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Sue, I want to get back to something you said earlier, which is you had to grieve again for...
I'll help you out. For Dylan,
The son that you had, and then the son that you had to come to terms with.
Yes.
And what was that like? Because we all, as parents, witness our children transition and change, and in some cases we grieve in our own ways. But this is such an acute, amazingly amplified example of that. And what was that like for you to have to not only recognize but accept what you came to accept in Dillon once you got there?
It was, it's terribly difficult. It turns you inside out. You question your love. You question, you know, did I not love him enough? Did I not raise him right? And, you know, and this is a very typical response pattern when one loses a child to suicide. You go back to every conversation you ever had. I remember seriously blaming myself for this because when Dillon was 3 years old, I bought a store-bought birthday cake, and I had decorated his brother's cake by hand, and therefore he must have felt loved less. I mean, you really, your mind goes to these places mm-hmm. that are ridiculous, but they feel very real. My way of coping with this was, it was so inexplicable, and it was so rare. It was, you know, as I said, it was the one in millions phenomenon, and I kept thinking, am I the worst mother out of 5 million mothers, or could it be something else? What else could this be? And having been a teacher for years, my approach to accepting this was to try to understand it. And so after a tragedy like this, the one thing that people do is they say, why did this happen? Why? And they look for things to blame. They look for things to say, it's the parenting, it's the bullying, it's the video games. You know, it's they like to wear trench coats. That must have been it. I mean, they look for specific things, but these are red herrings. These are not causes of something like this. So I really early on began to think, if we look for simple explanations of why these things happen, we'll never find the answer. What I wanted to focus on was how something like this could happen. What happens within a human being where they could become so different from who they are? And that's when I began to understand and to look for answers from the mental health community and really look at brain health. And I, you know, went to conferences and I read books and I talked with experts. And I began to see that when our brain is in a state of malfunction, we lose access to our tools of self-governance and reasoning. And I finally kind of began to understand what Dillon had probably experienced that led him to that terrible place.
Sue Klebold is our guest. She's Dillon Klebold's mother. A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy is her book. Even though this book was so difficult.
Yeah, both Lynn and I shared the same experience reading this, Sue. It's a very brave and courageous book that you've written. I think it's incredibly important. As I mentioned, it's something that's very topical and current for our community right now. I'm hoping that people who are listening are getting some ideas. I think it's a very important book for many people to read when you struggle with these issues of depression and adolescent development and some of the things that we're seeing in a lot of the schools across the country these days. And not just schools, I don't want to pin it on schools, but in communities. But of course, schools are the places our kids hang out. So it's kind of easy to call them out a little bit.
Yes.
Sue, a friend of mine posted on my Facebook post saying that we would interview you this morning, saying that you are so brave, and you are. So we thank you for being brave and for writing this book and for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for asking me to be here, and it's been a pleasure and an honor to speak with you.
All right. Take care, Sue.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be right back after this.
Josh Carr here, membership director at Park Meadows Country Club, sponsor of KPCW. Park Meadows offers an 18-hole Jack Nicklaus golf course, weekly ski groups, On Mountain Club, including parking and locker room at Chateau Deer Valley, cross-country skiing, fine dining, and fitness center. Golf and social memberships available at 649-2460 or on the web.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's.
And we'd like to thank our underwriters.
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park Meadows Country Club, Park City Mountain, San Francisco Design, Destination Hotels Utah, and Chateau Recovery.
And this is KPC.